hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sennett, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, rent control, housing, and economics. And Richard, we take this as our topic today because it's back in the news again thanks to Oregon, which is enacting the first statewide rent control regime that the country has ever seen. This is usually something that happens at the municipal level. So why don't we start here? People who examine rent control through a conventional sort of economics lens, you amongst them, are generally critical of such efforts, obviously, as we've talked about before on the show. That said, you have written at Defining Ideas that this proposal in Oregon is not subject necessarily to some of the excesses we've seen elsewhere, which is not to say that you think it's good, but rather that it may be more benign just because it's not likely to be all that effective. So why don't we start by having you kind of build the general case against rent control for us and then explain how the specifics color the analysis in Oregon.
Sure. I mean, essentially what happens is all of this stuff begins with the simple laws of supply and demand. And I always say to people when they're listening to the radio, think of an X. And one side of the X is going up from the left to the right, and that's the supply curve. And so essentially the horizontal axis is quantity. And what it says is as the amount that is being paid increases, the supply increases. And then the downward curve on the X is the demand curve. And what it says is that if it turns out that what you have to do is to pay a lot of money, you demand very little. If it turns out that you have to pay relatively little, you demand a lot. So one curve is creeping up and the other curve is creeping down. And essentially what they do is they reach an equilibrium. Now, in terms of the political science of this, is you can defend the supply and demands curve type situation as a stabilizing situation, even if you have no idea exactly what the equilibrium price is. Nor, in fact, does the model get weakened because the curves aren't linear. All you need to do is to say that one keeps going down and the other keeps going up. And therefore, what happens is, as things start to change, the equilibrium point starts to change. And what you do is you get a large number of small incremental changes in and out of housing markets. So if you look at a place like Chicago, which doesn't have a rent control law, essentially units turn over on a regular basis. There's a kind of an organized market on the dates. Leases close on May 31st or on October 31st. Before the beginning of summer, before the beginning of winter. And people tend to move back and forth because these markets are very smooth. And it turns out if you want to stay in a neighborhood and you don't have to, you're not in a rent control apartment, you're giving up something which has market value, you get something else which has market value. There's no great corpse. When you put a rent control statute on it, what you have to do is to now sort of imagine that there's a horizontal line and that this horizontal line is going to start to tell you whether or not the system is going to work. And if it turns out that the horizontal line is very high, what it means is that it's above the equilibrium price, and so it doesn't make much of a difference. And if you want an illustration in New York, the rent stabilization laws here may cover 2 million units or so, but roughly speaking, half of them, because they're located in Astoria, Queens, and other places, in fancy places in Brooklyn, a unit may, under the current system, rent for $2,500, and it may have, if all of the units remain under the system, a rental value of $11,000 or $12,000, which are what the non-control units go for. If you removed all of rent control, the equilibrium price would start to move down from that, but it would still be $5,000 or $6,000. So you're talking about a huge subsidy in that case. The Oregon statute, as drafted, essentially is not a market. It does not set any set of individual prices. What it says is you can get an increase of up to 7% per year with allowances for inflation. And there are very few markets, even those which are heated in demand, where it turns out that you're going to see steady year after year rent increases of 8 or 9%. Now, when you look at the Oregon situation, what it says is that rents, what they are now, is fine. There's no rollback. And then in future years, you get a 7% increase with allowances for inflation, which for most cases means about 8 or 9%. There are very few markets in which rents move up by that amount. So you'll probably stay below the cap, even if it turns out there's a huge influx of people coming from outside the jurisdiction. So at least as a first approximation, this is a little bit like a minimum wage law, with a minimum wage law so low that the wages are always above it, that nothing much really matters. The problem is in the long-term dynamics of the situation. If people still are upset about rent increases, what they may do is they say, we just don't have an effective enough rent control law. We've already agreed in principle that one is now required, but let's take that 7% and lower it to 2%. Let's get rid of the inflation allowance. And then within a year or two, you could have a major crisis. And that's essentially what happens in places like New York, where the stabilization law is always being pushed very, very hard. And de Blasio, for example, has championed zero rent increases even in the face of inflation. And then you get the challenges in court as to whether or not this is confiscation. In New York State, particularly in the state courts and in the Second Circuit, it has been virtually impossible to move the needle on that issue, no matter how draconian the situation. So it becomes a pure political play, and it's very difficult for out-of-state or out-of-city landlords to win against large numbers of tenants who live inside the city. And since they're long-term tenants with very favorable leases, they're very, very hard to displace.
This issue of housing affordability has come increasingly to the forefront in recent years, especially in a number of expensive major metros like New York, Boston, DC, LA, San Francisco. And this is sometimes waved away by people saying, well, these are the places people want to live. So if you get more demand, you're going to get higher prices. But in reality, there is pretty significant variance between major metro areas in terms of how high the housing costs are relative to the local incomes. Can you give us a sense of what the most common factors are that drive artificially high housing prices?
Well, artificial is a very powerful word, but if you take a place like San Francisco, the natural limitation is this is built on a peninsula filled with rock and surrounded on three sides by water. There just aren't a lot of places to go, and immediately to the south, there are other communities with different kinds of laws, so it's going to be constricted. But more importantly, you could always build up even if you can't build out, unless you get yourself into a situation where the zoning laws of one kind or another start to come into play. And this is very common in a place like California, where it's extremely difficult to get permission to build new units. And if you don't get the permission, then in effect what happens is the housing stock remains stagnant and starts to shrink indeed if some old units are necessarily taken out of service. The housing market has rentals, but it also has sales, and the two markets are to some extent complementary. And in a place like San Jose, for example, they have strong affordable housing regulations that are put into place. And affordable housing does apply to the creation of new homes, and you have to think of it as a system of price controls. The developer is allowed to charge as much as he or she wants for the market rate units, but has to give some fraction of the total production, 10, 20, maybe even 25%, over for people who are going to pay very much lower rates. The construction can differ a little, raising the cost for the entire system, both management and construction. And it turns out that many times you cannot recoup in the open market on the high rental units the amount of money you're forced to lose under the controlled housing. And so when that dynamic starts to take place, you get no new construction. So you put it all together, you have a laggard market with respect to new construction, and you have a constricted market with respect to rental housing, and you get a combined housing shortage which reflects itself in both markets. There's almost no way politically that you can impose a price cap on the resale prices of sitting tenants. So if you own something and you're a voter, you're going to be able to sell it free of rent control. But landlords will have to fight tenants who are in possession. And so it's easy, relatively speaking, to get a rent control law of one kind or another in place. And you start to seeing them in many, many cities. And then it just feeds on itself. You have a rent control law. Things are very, very tight. Many people are outside the system. And instead of liberalizing and letting more supply come into the marketplace, you tend to get even tougher on the rent control laws. And so the danger that you have in a place like Oregon is that that cycle will take place. There's a second danger, which is not to be mentioned, is rent control works. They are not pure price control laws. A price control law simply says you cannot sell gasoline at over $4 a gallon, but you can sell it to whomever you want. If rent control worked that way, the landlord would face a high ceiling on what he could charge, $2,000 for this unit, but could evict the current tenant and put somebody else into place. And so what rent control does is it's price controls plus automatic renewal. If you only had price controls without renewal, nobody would support the system because the current tenants would all be flushed out. And so once you do that, you then get real rigidities in these markets. People stay in units where they don't belong. I did a little survey of my own on the back of an envelope, so I don't want to claim too much about it. But one of the common phenomena you see in New York City is that people, older couples, widows, often stay in 3 or 4 bedroom apartments in New York City because of rent control, when if the units were deregulated, they'd move to a smaller place. So you think of what would happen to the city if you took, say, 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 of these units, and instead of having one or two persons in it, you have 3 or 4. You could add to the supply of housing by 500,000 people simply by taking these units and putting them in the hands of families where it starts to make sense. Rent control has all sorts of subtle losses like that. When you have rent control units, it reduces the property taxes on the units in question. That reduces the amount of money that's available for general streetwise improvements, and so the neighborhoods start to suffer. Then somebody wants to come up with a new building, and they play the exaction game and say, oh, well, you want to build a 20-story building in our particular neighborhood. We really are hurting because we don't have taxes from everybody else. We need to repair the railroad station or the train station, so we're going to put a special exaction on your particular unit. It's still worth it to you. You do this for us. And that then screws up the new entry market, as it's another form of sort of selective taxation. So the real danger on these things is they all tend to metastasize. And the only way in which you can stop it is to be very firm and say from beginning to end, this kind of practice is simply not to be regarded as respectable. And what happens in Oregon is the celebratory tones behind the rent control law, without the slightest awareness that there may be a downside to the way these things are organized, is what gets me very nervous, because the political momentum could easily lead to a genuine transformation in the way in which these markets will operate in the future.
In a lot of markets, you have, as you mentioned earlier, government regulations that require a certain amount of affordable housing be built. In some places, again, most notably New York City, you have a lot of public housing, where you might have housing vouchers. Is there, in your judgment, an appropriate role for government to play in the either provision or financing of housing for low-income people?
Well, I mean, my first instinct is always to say no, because generally thinking, every time you want to give a subsidy to one group, what happens is you have to impose an extra tax on another group. And so you're never going to have an overall positive sum situation. What you're going to do is to get political conflict as one class loses and another class wins. That means you're going to get dollars spent on both sides fighting, and those dollars are simply worth. And so I've always favored the situation where what you want to do is to relax the entry constraints, see the new entrants come in, watch the prices start to go down. You get rid of a bureaucracy on the one hand, and what you then start to do is to see more people starting to move in. Now, you can do this, but you have to understand that in cities like New York, there are two elements that interfere with the free market. One of them is there are many people who actually believe that when you talk about zoning, it's not an arbitrary system of exclusion, but it's a form of property rights. And so therefore, they argue the removal of a zoning system is like taking somebody's living room. And if you start to have that situation, once zoning's in effect, you've got a one-way ratchet. You can't undo the thing. So the only way that you can move is at the edges. You can upzone some areas so as to allow larger financial capacity to come in there. And then you're faced with the fact that sitting tenants may have to be bought out in order for the improvements to start to take place. Or you may give nice deals with respect to lands that's undeveloped, but then you find turf fights. This land is on the borderline between the Chinese and the Italian community. Which of these two groups is going to have dibs on the housing and so forth? And so it's very, very difficult to do that. The second thing, of course, that rent control does, and many other statutes do, is they make it very difficult to evict people at the end of leases. And so you don't get any circulation of the population. And it's not just one for one, because as I've mentioned before, it may well be if you get one person out, you're going to get two people in. In addition, one of the reasons why landlords like relatively short leases is if you have a multi-residential unit and you get one bad egg in there who's making noise or threatening other people, and you could expel them at the end of the lease, and then you keep your other tenants. If you can't, then many times the good tenants will start to go because you can't oust the bad tenant. So this whole market essentially requires that you get rid of both of these set of restraints in order for people to look as though it is a competitive market. Even then, you still have another problem. Land markets are known for their adjacencies. That is, you know, I build a nice house and you have a not so nice house next door. The value of your house is going to be impacted by the value of my house and vice versa. And so it becomes extremely difficult politically to allow new construction to start to take place because these physical externalities generate all sorts of political complications. And they could run in both directions. I do not want you to put a nice building next door to my building because I'm there on a short-term lease and I'm paying $300 a month. By the time you come in and make it a tonier neighborhood, we'll get gentrification. And now I'm up to $400 a month, which I can't afford. And if you believe that people have a right to stay in their current apartments on short-term leases at current rates, you're not going to have that happen. On the other hand, if you're a fancy guy and somebody else wants to come in next door and build something that's a little bit cheaper, the argument is going to be you're going to deteriorate the quality of the neighborhood. We can't tolerate that either. So by the time you're done, if you have every single plot having multiple neighbors with different agendas, it's a kind of a tricky thing to get this thing happen. So in places like New York, which are by no means as bad as many other cities on the new construction side, what typically tends to happen is you go way off to the side. That is, you go by the East River or by the Hudson River, particularly the Hudson River, and start to put up new developments there where you don't have a neighborhood that's being blocked. And then if you actually look at the way in which construction tends to take place in the interior of the city, there are building after building where you see all these parapets. And what they do is they keep the exterior and they gut the interior and they start over again because you don't have to go through the same process to interior renovations that you have to do when you want to take something down and start over. Landmarking, for example, is not something that's going to be involved in these two cases. So it is a very kind of complicated market. Nobody would ever say that land use markets are easier. It is easier to have a competitive equilibrium in a market for goods and services. And by no, it's not very easy to get it there. Think of the Trump tariffs and the minimum wage laws. But real estate markets are very, very tough. So if you can do it right, then you will start to get expansion and things will go just fine. So you take a city like Houston or Austin, you know, you want to get a building permit, a couple of weeks. Want to get a building permit in New York, it's probably easier to rob a bank because it's going to take you, you know, 3 or 4 years before this thing can sometimes go through. Community hearings of one kind or another. Everybody has standing to protest, and then it goes through a political process in the city and it has to go through layers on layers, and it's a game of shoots and ladders. You go up and you make one mistake, boom, down you go to the bottom and you got to start over again. You have to start over again. But unfortunately, your financing continues to go on. So what happens to many people is they buy land, they have to carry it, and then they hire an architect and they get more costs going on and they can't put anything up. And so if they have to wait 2 or 3 years, the carrying cost essentially makes the project uneconomical. It goes into bankruptcy. Some other foolhardy individual does the same thing. It is extremely important in these kinds of markets, whether you're talking about rent control or outright ownership, to make sure that what you do is to keep the markets fluid and never to make them rigid, and so that all the processes are essentially non-discretionary and they move very quickly, and that you have to make sure that they don't put these funny tie-ins, affordable housing, excessive amounts of parking, all sorts of other things that can derail a market like this. Are the courts any help? Essentially, no. at this particular point, they take a very laid-back, hands-off view. Their argument is, quite correctly, at one level, there are all sorts of externalities that are around here that we don't fully understand, and partial interventions could make things worse. But what happens is the moment you take that laid-back view, then all of a sudden they're not going to be worried about health and safety. These are all going to be largely anti-competitive maneuvers. And so the traditional view, which I hold, which is very much out of style today, is somebody puts forward an environmental justification for saying you're not allowed to build this new single-family home. You say, no, this is an anti-competitive measure. All you want to do is to make sure that the densities on your public street are lower. And then what you do is you ask them to point out what the environmental harm is. And it may well be that you're going to have a large house on a large lot of land like everybody's house next to yours. And the essential presumption should always be in those cases is if what's coming in is pretty much identical to what's already there, you've got no case for stopping it. Now, this is not perfect because you certainly want to allow neighborhoods like Berkeley to knock down some single-family homes and put up multi-family units and so forth, but at least it's a start. And what you have to slowly, slowly do for the courts, I think, is to get yourself involved in these cases, starting with the easy cases, then articulating the premises that you need to govern these judgments, which are health and safety are perfectly legitimate grounds, but restriction of competition are not. I'll look to see whether cases are dominantly one than another, and typically strike down many of these regulations, inviting the cities to give you something narrow. So to give you an example, I want to build something near a river. A total prohibition would seem to me to be utterly unacceptable with everybody else on the river having built. But if somebody says you need to have a settling pond so that the waste that comes from your particular operations is not going to reach the river, generally speaking, that's going to be presumptively okay unless it's really such an elaborate settling pond, so costly and so useless that it's simply a disguised restriction on development. Those tests can be developed and can be used, but only by courts that care to do it. And at this particular point, the attitude that I've described is more a 19th century attitude than a 20th or 21st century attitude. And so we are in a universe in which the courts, at least as today, are generally of relatively little help.
All right. You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.